Next case on the calendar today is County of Hennepin versus Sandeep Bhakta. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You are.
Thank you. Council will each have 15 minutes for your argument, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. Please identify yourself for the record and the client you represent. You can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ryan Somatic, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Sandeep Bhakta and his wife, Jagruti Bhakta. I'm going to ask that this court reverse the district court. I'm going to ask for two alternative remedies here. One is a remand for a new trial, and one is simply to enter an order on the remaining evidence, which will be undisputed. To refresh the court's recollection, this is a condemnation matter where Hennepin County seized the private property of citizens, the Bhaktas, against their will for a public project. Now, this case involved a relatively new remedy. It's under section 117.187, and it's called minimum compensation. What does that statute say? It says that the award in this case, at minimum, must be sufficient for the Bhaktas to purchase a replacement property within the community. Now, what does that mean? Well, this court has said it means that the fact finder, in this case a jury, must rely on the traditional approaches to calculating market value. That was in the Cameron case. The court went on to say, this court went on to say, that instead of valuing the taken property, the focus shifts to the market value of comparable properties within the community of the taken property. So, either way you look at it, what we're dealing with is the market value of real estate. Now, in this case, the county's purported expert on minimum compensation, Helvey, testified at trial that he was not providing testimony on the market value of the Bhakta property, and in fact, he was not providing testimony on the market value of any property. But that is exactly what this court has said is the legal focus of the minimum compensation remedy. So we know that evidence offered by Helvey was legally incompetent. And because that turns out...
Counsel, what language in the Cameron case are you relying on to say that it has to be market value or basically an appraisal?
In Cameron 1, which is the Court of Appeals decision, this court said the following, and I'm quoting, the fact finder must, quote, rely on traditionally utilized market value approaches. That is at 812 Northwest 2nd, 861. The court went further and said, again, I'm quoting, quote, instead of determining the market value of the taken property, the focus shifts to the market value of comparable properties in the community. And that is, again, 812 Northwest 2nd at 861. So the two of those combined is what I'm relying on to say that the focus of this minimum compensation must be market value of real property.
But up above in the paragraph above, the last sentence says, although the list or offer price may be an appropriate consideration when a comparable property in the community is available for purchase at the time of taking, it's not the only basis for a damages calculation under the minimum compensation statute. So doesn't that indicate that you could also consider purchase price?
Well, Your Honor,
not you, but the court could consider purchase price as evidence.
I have to ask a clarifying question. When you say purchase price, do you mean an actual closed transaction or at arm's length, or do you mean a listing price?
a listing price, the price of a property that's available for purchase?
I think that's something that a court could consider. I think that's something an expert could potentially consider. But I don't think it's dispositive, and I don't think it's the focus of the remedy either. You can take that into consideration when you are doing an ultimate determination of market value, but market value remains the touchstone of this remedy.
Could I?
What happens when you really don't have a comparable?
Well, you're asking me to come forth with a hypothetical that is not applicable in this case. I think...
Why isn't it applicable? There doesn't really seem to be a comparable, at least in the immediate community the property was in. I know there's one southwestern Minnesota and there are a couple down there, but...
Yeah, I think that when the two parties are submitting expert evidence saying that these are the comparable properties, and the Supreme Court has said that what is and what isn't a comparable property is a technical term used in real estate valuation. If it's a technical term, then it is the province of an expert to say this is comparable and this is not. So in this case, there are comparables. The parties just disagree on what they are. And I think in most cases, you're going to find that an expert will be able to identify some type of property that is comparable within the community of the condemned property. If there's not one at all, then perhaps the expert can use some kind of cost analysis, because what the remedy is truly just a monetary remedy. It's not a guarantee that the party can purchase a comparable property. So long as it's the equivalent of what the market value would be, that's satisfactory, whether there is or isn't an actual comparable.
But wouldn't a comparable then have to be of similar age, style, room numbers, condition?
Well, whatever in the industry, the appraisal industry, would say it's comparable, that would be what the expert has to consider, and then in turn the jury. So, I mean, you can't have a shack and say that the replacement property is the Taj Mahal. But I think there are various methods, all based on market value, that can deliver a monetary number to a jury, which the jury can weigh and say that's an appropriate amount or that's not an appropriate amount.
In this case, was the jury asked to find two numbers or one number? In other words, were they asked to find just the minimum, the replacement value?
Just to be precise, I'm not sure a replacement value is what they were asked to find. No. But they were asked to find, I believe, one number, which was what is the minimum that it would take for BACTA to purchase a comparable property within the community.
So before the jury, there was no dispute about the market value of their actual motel property.
That's right. They weren't asked to decide what that would be just compensation, because that is the market value of the taken property. They weren't asked, right. Were not asked to decide that, from my recollection of what was submitted to the jury.
So it seems that the testimony of Helvey was offered for a limited purpose, but he wasn't the only witness the county presented. I mean, why is it not permitted for the county to offer, one witness who testifies to these issues, but another witness who testifies to appraisals of the comparable properties?
Well, they absolutely would be allowed to do that. But in this case, they offered two distinct witnesses. One, Jason Messner, testified to the market value of the taken property alone. And that's what he testified to at trial. I said, are you testifying about the market value of other properties? No, I'm testifying about the market value of the taken property only. Helvey, on the other hand, was the expert who specifically confirmed at trial that his testimony goes to minimum compensation. So they're free to offer those two witnesses, certainly, for those two different remedies.
So why haven't you argued that the evidence is insufficient? I mean, the evidence the county put in was insufficient to prove to support the jury's verdict. I mean, you're attacking the admissibility, but you never attack the sufficiency.
Because to be perfectly frank, I think that the admissibility is the better argument here, because it really goes to what is this remedy all about. And I think it's harder to just attack a jury verdict and saying what they presented was insufficient. I think the better tack at this is to say what they presented never should have been presented to the jury at all, and in any event did not purport to give the jury what they needed to make its decision.
Just a couple of thoughts. Why didn't you participate in the commissioner hearing, and why didn't your client testify to his or her sense of value at the trial itself?
As to the first one, we did participate in the commissioner's hearing. We just didn't participate in it to the county's liking. We had the owner testify as to the value at before the commissioners. Now, regarding the trial, if you really want my inside baseball take on why I wouldn't have had him testify, it's because, and I hate to say this, but he has a very thick accent and it's hard to understand him on the stand. So I didn't think that that would be the best testimony to establish this. Moreover, he's not an expert on the value of properties beyond his. So he couldn't testify to minimum compensation. He can only testify to the market value of his own property. So.
I'd be interested to hear argument about the offset issue before your time has expired.
Yes, I can absolutely do that. Could I just get into one other thing that I think is supremely important for the court?
As you wish.
So in this case, we also challenged the qualifications of Helvey to give this opinion. And that was via a motion in limine before trial. And if you look in the record, the district court made no finding whatsoever that Helvey was qualified to give his opinion. And that was an abdication of the district court's gatekeeping function. Questions about whether an expert is properly qualified are the gatekeeping function of the court, and it must make a decision on it. It is mandatory.
Was there an objection?
An objection to what?
To his giving expert testimony without a ruling on qualifications?
No, but under State versus Litzau, once you object to an expert based on their qualifications, if it's admitted, you don't have to renew that objection at trial. So my objection is that he's not qualified. That's a sustained objection, even if he testifies at trial.
In your motion in limine?
Correct. and it occurred to me, well, what happens?
Can I ask you a little bit about that?
Yes.
Respondent argues that the information in the minimum compensation analysis performed by Mr. Helvey was provided back in 2012, and that's sufficient. Did that analysis give the information that's required under the expert disclosure provision of 26.01?
Not completely, no, because it didn't provide qualifications, compensation, or prior testimony. But it occurred to me what happens when the district court abdicates its great gatekeeping function. Now, the leading federal cases have an answer to this. So the leading expert testimony cases on admissibility are Daubert and Kumho Tyre, and they both hold that this gatekeeping function is mandatory. I'm going to cite a few federal cases, and since they came to my attention after the brief, I will provide a Rule 12508 letter so you don't have to keep track of them now. But the 11th Circuit holds in U.S. v. Frazier that this is a mandatory function. The 1st Circuit in Smith versus Jenkins, the same. The 10th Circuit, U.S. v. Avidia Guillen, the same. And this court, under a recently unpublished case called Kedrowski, arguably holds the same thing, that where someone challenges the qualifications of an expert, the district court has to perform that gatekeeping function. So what happens when it doesn't? I argued in my brief that this court need not defer to the trial court on whether Helvey was qualified because there is nothing to defer to. The federal cases basically back me up on this. What does a district court have to do to satisfy its gatekeeping function? Not a lot, but there are two things. One, it must make specific findings about the admissibility or inadmissibility of the challenged expert evidence. Two, it must make a record thorough enough so that this court can conduct meaningful review. And it did neither in this case. It simply said, you can deal with this on cross-examination. That is an automatic abuse of discretion. The 10th Circuit has said in Kirby that the district court must take this function seriously. It's not enough to just admit the evidence. In other words, there's no implied finding of qualification. You have to conduct the gatekeeping function. The 7th Circuit in Gopaltranam says that more than just a conclusory statement of admissibility is required. In that case, the court further said that one sentence saying that the offered expert qualifications were sufficient was not enough. We need more than this. We need to know the basis for why this expert is qualified or not qualified. The First Circuit in Smith has said that abdication is not sufficient.
Counsel, could you get to the offset issue?
Yes, I'm sorry,
Your Honor. We have 50 seconds remaining.
I can also finish up on rebuttal. On the offset issue, the district court has no authority to, no statutory authority to offset property taxes against a judgment. Property tax liens, they exist on the property only. Once the condemnation happens, they are extinguished. What is the county supposed to?
Was there a debt? But let's set aside, I mean, liens and debts are different things, right? Was there a debt?
There was a debt, but liens and debts.
Go ahead.
Liens and debts are different, Your Honor. And in this case, the Beersdorf firm would have had a priority lien. Moreover,
no, but,
once...
But your client owed property taxes. The county paid them, paid themselves the property taxes. Doesn't that give rise to just simply a claim for indemnification or against the Bakhtas?
No. No, because property taxes attach. I'm sorry, property taxes. My time is up, but I'll be brief. Property taxes attach to property only. So, what happens when somebody doesn't pay them? You can have a tax foreclosure, but it is not a personal obligation, like a traditional debt, that would transfer into other venues.
You can respond on rebuttal if you need additional
Thank
clarification.
You.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Louis Robards. I represent Hennepin County in this condemnation action as the appellee. I'd like to first address the issue of Mr. Helvey's qualifications and his ability to testify. As pointed out in the county's brief, Mr. Helvey was, pursuant to Rule 702, did qualify by education, by training, and by experience. He'd been involved in relocation issues, actually the exact thing that the statute is dealing with, for 24 years. He had started out in the company, became the owner of the company. The company was purchased by a major company, SRF Consulting, which is a multi-state engineering and right-of-way company, and he manages the same relocation issues now with a group of people in three states. He clearly was qualified to testify about the cost to purchase a comparable property in the community because he had been doing that for over 24 years.
You know, I've just...
Yes.
This concept of in the community seems to be fluid and can be really large or really small.
Right.
And there doesn't seem to be a lot of parameters on how we get there. What's your position on that? Because the sites that are mentioned don't seem to be in the community to me. They seem to be quite a ways away, in another county perhaps?
That's true. Somewhere they were all in roughly the metropolitan area. One was just over the river in Dakota County from the airport. Cameron, and the Supreme Court case I would mention is the controlling case here. There was a Court of Appeals decision that was referred to by counsel when asking or answering a question about Cameron. But the Cameron case defines a community. It could be a small city. It could be a county. It could be in location. It could even be statewide. One difficulty in this case, and a significant difficulty, was, and I'll use roughly a counsel's analogy, you can't claim an old house that's run down is equivalent to the Taj Mahal. As was pointed out in the record in this case, which was brought out in the exhibits and in the testimony, discussions at the trial and in the final argument. This property, the Bachta property, was in very, very poor condition. The quality of trying to find a comparable property in the immediate or in any community was very difficult. There simply was none. This was, as was pointed out, there were numerous health issues, not just dealing with superficial things, but of the quality of the building, and that the national firm of Budget Host International, which has franchises, it's not the Holiday Inn, it's not the Hilton, but it's a very basic quality type motel. Even they, after a year's warning, revoked the franchise to the motel because of its poor upkeep. And I'll leave that to the court, the description of what the code compliance from Brooklyn Park found is was part of the record and was explained in the final argument. So the difficulty in finding something in any community close to that was very, very difficult. In addition, trying to find a comparable property at the time, it was assumed, as explained in the Cameron case, that it had to be property for sale. At that time in 2012, actually property owners were claiming that it couldn't just be another property out there for a price. It had to be actually for sale. The Cameron court...
Doesn't the case say that it can be now?
Pardon me?
Doesn't the case say it can be, though?
That's right. Cameron expanded it quite a bit. It didn't rule out listings, which is what the county's Mr. Helvey, the county's relocation expert, did rely on, properties that were actually for sale that the owner could buy, and he used those prices, all of which, and I would point out, his value was roughly $755,000, which the county paid up front to the owner.
And the trial was in 2017, so you could have updated the analysis between 2012 and 2017.
That's true. It could have been done. The county's position...
So did Mr. Helvey define the community for purposes of his analysis?
He stated in his testimony that he had talked directly with the owner, and which, by the way, I don't believe the others... The other appraiser for the landowner did do that, but he talked three or four times. He met with him. He inspected the entire building, which the other appraiser did not, the owners, and talked with him several times about what he wanted, and he testified that he said something roughly in the beltway of 494 and 694 was what he talked about, and there was never any mention about anything nearby, like where his daughter went to school. None of that came up. But he found nothing for sale within the beltway, even, that was like the subject property. There just wasn't anything that really compared that was available. But the ones that he did find, and he included in his written analysis, was were the ones that were one in Egan, one across...
And there's one in Taylor's Falls, which is outside the Beltway.
Pardon me?
There's one in Taylor's Falls, which is outside the Beltway. Correct?
That is true.
And yeah. New Prague.
That was outside the Beltway. What I guess what was difficult for this jury to do was to, and maybe not so difficult, because they came to a pretty clear conclusion of what, after hearing all of the testimony, and while I did get somewhat off the track in my brief, I pointed out exactly what the owner's appraiser did was never actually put any kind of value on the subject property, that is the Bachta Motel itself, ignored it completely, what it was worth, but went out and found another property and then went outside the Beltway altogether in making his analysis as far as finding properties that were extremely high quality, swimming pools, business conference centers, et cetera, which is explained. But the difficulty here was trying to find something that was comparable, and the quality of this property was, quite frankly, so low, it was difficult to find one. So I don't know if that...
I think that answers the question.
The statute seems to assume that you're going to, so what do we make of that?
Pardon me?
The statute assumes that you're going to be able to find a comparable property, so how do we deal with
that? Well, the statute says when an owner must relocate, the owner is entitled at a minimum to the cost to purchase a comparable property in the community. What Mr. Helvey did was to try, as he had done for years in his practice, try to help this property owner find a property that he could purchase in the community. And so finding none that was exactly comparable to what the owner had, he then found that those three that were actually for sale that were located in Egan, Taylor's Falls, and blanking on the third location, but it was also outside the Beltway. But what the statute said, the task is, what would it cost? And under Cameron, it's just a monetary value. What is you don't have to buy it anymore. You can take the money and retire under the Cameron Supreme Court decision. So the question was, what is this property, what would it cost to buy something similar to what the Bakhtas owned? And what he found were, here are three listings. Now, listings were argued is not admissible, but they weren't excluded by Cameron. Cameron expanded it to other things. But listings were something that would be the high point. Here's one that you could actually purchase, and maybe you could purchase it for less than that under a normal bargaining position. But these were listings that were, and I would point out, he was at $755,000. The county had an appraiser, an MAI, that's the kind of the CPA of the appraisal profession, who was highly qualified, and he found a comparable market value of the Bakhta property. He actually went through the Bakhta, looked at it all, and found that on the market, the Bakhta property, he said, was worth $676,000. So the minimum compensation value, which was also submitted to the jury, was 100 over that. And the jury verdict was 810. So all of this falls within the range of what are, you know, reasonable.
Well, in that appraisal, too, he found on the income approach, the value, and then on the market approach, a value that was $1,000 closer. So he had used two of the three approaches to get to that number. Is that
that's
fair
true
statement?
Right. I don't recall exactly what his market was and his income was, but what he did is a similar thing to what he came up with a value, and he in the end you reconciled both of the approaches.
Well, it seems in this property that the income approach would make the most sense to me.
Right, and I think that's what he testified
to. Well, I think he did them both, but they came out about the same. But the unusual thing here is that their home was attached in part of the property, too, so that
right.
You can't just rely on income. You have to look a little further, it seems.
That's true, and what he did, he made an adjustment for that. In coming up with the value that there was a living quarters. The living quarters was basically, it's in the exhibits, and there were many pictures, and there's a door where the office is, and there's a little checkout window or where you pay and slide your card under the window. And behind that was a door that led to their apartment. They had two bedrooms that went down into the basement. So behind that, they had a dining room or a family room and a kitchen area, and there were two bedrooms. So what was found and what Mr. Helvey did was he had a value for the motel, and then he also looked at what it would, I think he added $120,000 for the cost for them to purchase a home. It's in the record. They purchased a home on a lake in Maple Grove that was far more than what they had, but it really doesn't matter. But
and you could actually maybe buy a two-bedroom for $120,000
in
2011.
Right, yeah. I mean, and they were free to do whatever they wanted to do. There was nothing that would force them to do one or the other.
Appellant argues that the value of their hotel isn't relevant, though. It's the value of a comparable property that could be some other property. What's your response to that?
Well, we simply disagree with that. I think, and I don't think that's what Cameron mandates that you have to do. I mean, the common sense, first of all, is that, as counsel even pointed out, if you don't take a low-quality house and be allowed to purchase a Taj Mahal. And I think the Court of Appeals decision in the Court of Appeals decision in Cameron stresses the point that this is not an opportunity for a windfall. This is an opportunity for to find another way of coming up with a fair amount of compensation of what it would cost to purchase a similar property. When they say similar property, similar to what the county submits it, similar to what you had. It's not an opportunity to find something that's better, significantly better, and I think there was quite a bit of cross-examination on that point. But
you know, just as an example, say you something that would be simpler, you're taking a person's property that's their home, that's a three-bedroom rambler, and the only comparable property to the extent that it's a three-bedroom rambler in the community is a newer property, so it's going to be more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean we don't look at that? I mean, that's a far cry from the Taj Mahal. Isn't there a place in between where that may be, in fact, instead of $300,000, $400,000? Are we going to say that isn't what you look at in that kind of a circumstance?
No, not necessarily. You know, in other words, you're correct. You don't necessarily exclude that, but if you have what appraisers do is make adjustments. If in the market approach, which what an appraiser would do in their analysis would be to look at other properties. If you have a house and the house across the street sells and it sells for another $100,000, it might be because they have a remodeled kitchen and that they have a completely finished basement. It's those kind of adjustments that are made. And I would point out that the county's appraiser, Jason Messner, who did come up with $676,000, he made those kind of adjustments and he came up with a fair market value of what that indicated for the Bakta property, and that was his 676, which would be very similar to what Helvey did because he added on the extra.
Council, I have one more question for you. I know your time is almost
yes.
up. Did the county comply with the disclosure requirements of Rule 26.01 for the expert, Mr. Helvey?
We think we did. We think that what was given to the owners back before the law firm even became involved with them was the Helvey's written analysis and Messner's written appraisal report. That was the same thing that was used at the commission hearing, which...
Did that include the expert's qualifications?
His expert's qualifications were covered in the... his testimony at the commission hearing, which they didn't participate in, but he was cross-examined on all of that or had the opportunity to be. So all of that was right there. And our, I guess, summary is that there was nothing at this trial that was said about this property value that was not said 2.5 years before that at the commission hearing at which there was a reporter and a transcript made, which the transcript was used to cross-examine all of those witnesses at the trial in detail. It's in the record. But that was known 5 years beforehand. Nothing changed over that 5 years. Nothing, absolutely nothing changed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Perhaps we can start with the offset issue since that was a bit truncated. Taxes assessed against real estate are a charge against the land only and do not create a personal liability on the part of the landowner. That's State versus Rude and Freiberger. So if I want to keep my property, I have to pay my property taxes. Otherwise, the county can foreclose on it. But if I don't pay them and I just move off the property, the county can foreclose on it, but what they cannot do is treat that as any other debt. They can't come after me for it because it's not a personal liability. So once those liens are extinguished, that's it. You can't go after the owner anymore. Moreover, the district court here did not treat it as a debt. It treated it as a lien. In its order, it said all property tax liens are the responsibility of BACDA. So it didn't analyze it in the way of it did. It said it was a lien. It wasn't. There was no lien in place once that trial was over. There was no lien in place from the moment the county condemned that property. As soon as that happens, they're gone. They get clean title, and they can't come after the prior property owner for delinquent property taxes at that point. Regarding whether, is there any other questions on that matter? No, okay. Regarding whether Helvey was qualified, under the 10th and 1st Circuit models, abdication of that gatekeeping function, which is exactly what happens here, is automatic abuse of discretion, automatic reversal. So it doesn't matter if
Counsel,
he was qualified or not.
If you can limit your rebuttal to the argument of respondent, I don't think the gatekeeping function was raised by respondent.
Sure. Okay.
I allowed you some leeway on the offset issue because of
Understood.
The question, and you were limited in time earlier.
Regarding the community, the issue was raised, did Mr. Helvey define a community? No, he did not. He testified at trial that he let the availability for sale define where he was looking for properties. He did not come up with a community and then look within that community. We objected to that, saying that was a foundational flaw to his testimony. Regarding the very nature of the minimum compensation statute, it does not mean the value of the property that was taken, because if it did, then it means nothing at all, because the just compensation is the market value of the property that was taken. That's in our Constitution. That has been in our case law for hundreds of years, and we cannot presume that the legislature meant to do nothing when it enacted this statute. That is against the canons of statutory construction. They meant to do something here, and I'm saying what it was is exactly what this court has already said it was. It shifts the focus to market value of properties within the community instead of the taken property itself.
And is it your position that the comparable or a comparable property has to be an actual property, can't be a hypothetical or...
I think it has to be a real property, yes. It has to exist. It may not have to be for sale, but it has to exist.
If it's a very shallow market, or if there's very few, even of the general category of properties on the market.
It may be that there's very few, but I leave that to the legislature to correct, because they're the ones that created this remedy. And it may at times be a constrained remedy, but that's just the way that it is.
But you're not arguing that they have to be on the market, are you?
No, I'm not. The Supreme Court
they just have to exist in the community.
Correct. Correct.
Was any effort made to make an offer to an owner of a comparable property that was not listed?
No. Nope. That's not in the record. And I don't know that it happened. Regarding the compliance with Rule 2601B that Your Honor raised, no, the county did not comply with that, because there's more to it than just saying, this is what my report says. The rule specifically requires disclose all prior testimony, disclose compensation, disclose qualifications. None of that ever happened. Look in the record. There's an affidavit for me saying I never received these. Here's mine. They're of record. The counties are not of record anywhere because it never happened. And just very briefly, regarding the listings, that was also objected to as a foundational flaw and not addressed once again by the district court. And I see my time is up.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. Appreciate your briefing and your arguments. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.